What is up, everybody? Welcome back to Vintage and Stuff Podcast. You're rocking with me, Drew Heifetz, and today I have Nick, aka Spare Bricks _ on Instagram, and this is the Patagonia Nerd episode. We are going to dive super deep into all things Patagonia history, product talk, rare details, differences between certain garments, values of garments, what makes something collectible, talk about like tons of their most popular lines. And if you're interested in Patagonia, you're definitely going to want to listen to this episode. If you're interested in reselling, you're definitely going to want to listen to this episode. There's a lot to learn for the collectors, a lot to learn for anybody who has ever found a Patagonia garment, a lot to learn about vintage, about the history of the company. So yeah, this is the Patagonia Nerd episode. And the reason I got my man Nick on the show is because he knows more than anybody. I found him because he was posting a lot of stuff that was way deeper than the knowledge I had on certain garments. And again, like, I love the shit. I don't know everything. And it's good to have somebody like Nick come on and tell us more than we already know. So thank you guys for tuning in. Stoked to be back here. Took a little break from the show, but we are back rolling out weekly episodes once again, bringing you lots of knowledge that are going to help you in your business on the day-to-day. So buckle your seatbelts, and here we go on the Patagonia episode. Right, Nick, welcome to the show, my man.
Thank you for having me.
So Nick is coming to us from his dorm room at UMass, and we are going to be talking about everything Patagonia today.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
So why don't you kick this off? You know, I'm excited to get into this. You know that I am a Patagonia fan, collector, and you kind of hit me up a while ago, or actually, yeah, I think you hit me up, and then I got to sort of see what you're posting, and you're also a collector, and you're very invested into the history, into the knowledge, the details of the clothing. So just give us the rundown of how you got interested in Patagonia and what interests you about it, how you started collecting.
Oh, man. I'd say I first ran into Patagonia as a high schooler, and I would only see like the basic P6 logo tees. And I actually thought it was like a preppy brand, like Vineyard Vines or something, because it was always the jocks that would wear it. So that's sort of like a negative connotation at first. But then later, when I was like 18, 19, I got into streetwear, and naturally fleeces got into that. So I picked up a Retro X on sale at a skate shop. And it was like my beater fleece for the longest time. And long story short, I ended up working at a pre-owned designer and vintage store in Boston. And through that, I got to interact with a lot of pieces and sort of piqued my interest. And I would see some pieces on Instagram here and there as well. And in fact, your collection videos back in like 2021, 22, those were pretty like foundational for me, I would say. Seeing other people get enthusiastic about it. And, it was sort of just like a slippery slope from there. I just got deeper and deeper into it.
That's awesome. So the first thing you said there is that you picked up a Retro X at a skate shop. Did the skate shop have a rack of vintage or something out? Like,
No. Theory out here in Western Mass, they're a snowboard and skate shop. So they actually have a Patagonia account.
Oh, no way.
Picked up a Retro X on sale for like $100.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's rad. And tell us more about this designer consignment shop you worked at.
So, like freshman year of high school or college, I got together with some friends and we started online fashion magazine. We were on the street wearing designer fashion, and over the pandemic, that actually evolved into opening up what was originally a pop-up shop on Newbury in Boston, but it evolved into getting flowing through vintage dealers, having them consign stuff, and that's when I actually got into like vintage as well as Patagonia at first. A lot of the vintage dealers I know right now go all the way back to that. So we would get some pieces in. I would be in the stock room actually, pricing stuff up and trying it on, interacting with it. That was very foundational for
Cool.
me.
How did that store do?
We did pretty well. But internal conflicts led to it being done by like we started in like November 2020 and it was done by like April 21.
It's too many
Pretty quick.
partners, couldn't come together
Yeah, something like that.
as collaboratives. Well, classic story. That shit happens. Okay, sweet man. So what are you studying there at UMass?
Oh, I study art history.
Oh, nice. So you're into history all around.
Oh, big time. Yeah.
Nice. All right, so I'm excited. This is going to be the Patagonia nerd episode. We're gonna dive into history. We're gonna dive into all these interesting details about the clothing. We're gonna talk about the company, Yvon Chouinard. And just see where this conversation goes. I think we both have a lot of interest in it and know a lot about it. So, and
Oh,
I might
yeah.
even be like referencing some real data and some articles to talk about certain aspects of what's going on over there. So yeah, Nick, kick it off. Like, let's just start at the very beginning here. The history and founding of the company with Yvon Chouinard.
Yeah, so Chouinard is a legendary climber. He got his start in terms of product, he was a blacksmith, and that's how he like paid to go on all these climbing trips back in like the 50s and 60s. And that sort of evolved into Chouinard Equipment, which was like his hard goods business, doing pitons and all the fittings for climbing, because what was available at the time was either poor quality or was like detrimental to the environment. So he and his friends like got together, made up a bunch of literature on clean climbing, as they called it, and he became like a well-known figure in like the Yosemite scene back in the late 60s. But
Yeah,
around the
that's interesting to talk about that era for a minute. Like when we talk clean, I'm not a climber. I just know the history from what I know, but I guess the clean climbing discussion is that people would put the pitons in the rock and leave them. They never could get taken out, right? And then clean climbing movement was to like create these things that you could put in the rock and take out of the rock, so you didn't have to leave it, like leave no trace camping similarities. And prior to like the climbing movement of this era, climbing was like this like European mountaineer Swiss endeavor. I'm trying to paint a picture here where like people would like put up ladders up the cliff and then like climb up ladders. And it was way more of like a gentleman's kind of sport. It wasn't
Oh yeah.
really,
This is
you know
like
what I
British
mean?
dudes who wanted to show off and like it was like the next level of like Ernest Shackleton dudes going to the Arctic. The next thing they wanted to do is go all the way up on the highest mountains.
Yeah, exactly. So it was like they would just get to the highest mountain by any means necessary, not caring about the process. And then this generation started to care about how we did it. It's more about the sport of it. Yeah, anyway, continue on. So it was at this time like Chouinard Equipment. Actually, one more thing I will actually we'll talk about that later. Chouinard Equipment at this point was do you know if it started in California, in what's the town where it's at right now?
Ventura.
Ventura, yeah.
He had like his workshop there, and Patagonia headquarters is like attached to that right now. Like they're still in that area. His original workshop is still there.
Yeah, I've been to that. I surf near there because literally, if you go to the Patagonia headquarters now, it's like two blocks from C Street, which is one of the most famous like Ventura, well, probably the most famous Ventura surf break.
Yeah.
And I think some of the same, it's literally like they just renovated the same buildings that they were in those old days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So Great Pacific Ironworks, that, that's like the umbrella company that Chouinard Equipment was under. And then, around 1972, Chouinard was on a hiking trip in, or a climbing trip in Scotland. And it was there that he encountered these Umbro rugby shirts at like a sportswear store. And he started looking at them and thought they were like perfect for climbing. And they also looked really good. So he picked up a few, brought them back to California. And like everybody on the walls were like, what are you wearing? Because they're so colorful and evocative, and also really, really functional with like the very thick collars. They're perfect for putting slings around and all that. And so he eventually got the idea to start importing them and selling them to his fellow climbing friends. And that sort of grew into a business of him importing clothing from like private label, slapping his own labels on them in many cases. So that was like the software arm of Great Pacific Ironworks, as it was originally known. And then it became Patagonia Software, essentially.
Yeah. It's a wicked cool history, if you ask me, because it's very like born out of functionality, born out of a need for something, right?
Exactly. When you
look back at like all the like kind of like history in the mountains, history in sports, it doesn't evolve without the equipment to let it evolve. You know what I mean? And and this is like one of those innovations, right? So he's like, he gets these shirts, like you said, from Europe, these Umbro shirts. The collar, I think, was really good because he could flip the collar and have the rope like around.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't rub your neck.
Put a sling over your shoulder. Yeah.
Yeah. And then also like those rugby shirts, everyone can probably agree, like the thickness of the cotton is like a bit heavier. It's like a nice thick cotton.
Yeah.
So I think at the time nobody was making a sport specific climbing anything, right? They were just
not probably, really. No.
Yeah. So yeah, they're like, they're rubbing up against rock. They're like, these things are durable. Those rugbies also have like reinforced elbows because these guys are like rolling around in the freaking dirt with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And these things are freaking awesome. And he's like, damn, these are sick. So we're going to put some pictures. I have the evolution of these rugbies, which you've probably seen from my videos. It's like the original 70s rugby. Then there's the rugby that is the Umbro rugby that he put the Chouinard label in. Then there's like the Great Pacific. I think there's one that has like a Great Pacific Ironworks specific tag. And then eventually it's like he's producing a very similar look-alike rugby under the Patagonia early tag. There's a white tag and even a black tag.
Yeah. Like I think he started outsourcing them private label at a certain point and making them under his own name. But the first thing that they actually made themselves, the first clothing designed by Patagonia, was the stand-up shorts in like the mid-70s. And that came out of like, he really wanted, a really durable short slash pant. So he got like the thickest like duck canvas you can possibly get. And they started making these shorts out of them. And the stand-up name comes with the fact that you could literally put them on a table and they would stand up. And that was their first original clothing design.
Yeah, probably super uncomfortable, the original prototypes of those. You're like,
you have to like really break those in.
Yeah, you're like 6 months on the north wall before these things are like broken in, you know what I mean?
for sure.
That's you know, again, like the heavy canvas, he's trying to make something that would last, like rubbing up against rock time and time again. They have these like huge back pockets with these like funky curvature.
Yeah, it's like a D-ring pocket. Yeah.
They're very interesting. And again, like this is something that they still make to this day, and they probably still make the rugbies to this day, but the stand-up short has been like one of their key designs throughout the whole history of the company.
Yeah, rugbies and the stand-up shorts, staples.
Yeah. And you know, looking at that, looking at how much longevity they've had out of those products, you're like, wow, that's crazy. Most companies don't last more than a season with a certain product, right? Because they're so focused on style and fashion. But when you design and build out of function, things become timeless. And you're like, if this works for the function, we're, and people still need something for that function, it technically can last forever. And then it even transcends itself into fashion because of that, because now it's like, you know, it has a purpose, and the details for that purpose create, you know, I think some sort of beauty, right?
Oh, big time. That whole, form follows function type thing.
Yeah. I think that's, I've always been like that. I always think that about clothing in general, like military clothing, so much of it is transcended into fashion. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like there's all the best innovation in clothing has come from some sort of functional need, whether it's military, whether it's climbing, like we're talking about here, whether it's, mining, cowboy culture, like it could have been anything, but it's like they designed for a purpose, and then it transcends history and becomes like the most iconic things in fashion.
Yeah, that's really how I got into vintage, honestly, because I was into designer and streetwear, and most of those designs are appropriated from military vintage pieces, and I was like, I might as well just get the original or something that's more closely connected to that for a way cheaper price and something that was more akin to what I was going after.
Yeah, I think that's cool to kind of touch on too, because I think that sort of like same thing that happened to you with streetwear into like the roots of where the designs came from happened to a lot of people through this like sneaker culture, then streetwear. And then they're like, wow, there's like all this history behind it. And when you start to unravel the layers or peel back the layers, it becomes more interesting, right?
Oh, yeah. You get sucked into the whole history of what that reference piece is, where that comes from, whatever brand that came from. Yeah.
Yeah, it's really cool. So I think that has a big piece in booming in the business. In general, like after a while, when you've been in vintage, you can go to the mall. And you could be like, that's from a military peacoat. That's an M41. Mm. That's like a copy of a 501. That's this, that's this, that's this. Because there's very little completely new. Like no one's like inventing a new type of garment. They're just referencing different things and putting pieces together.
Yeah, for the most part, unless you get into like really high-end like couture runway stuff.
Yeah. And then nobody wears that shit anyway. That's just for,
exactly.
Just for show.
not even functional. Yeah.
All right. So let's continue on. So we're at the point with the stand up short. So I guess at that point, was the Patagonia name already brought into it, or were the first stand up shorts in like a Chouinard Equipment label?
Yeah. The first ones were under Chouinard Equipment, Great Pacific Ironworks. They would have like double tags usually. But it wasn't until around 1974, Patagonia became a thing. It was originally Patagonia Software. That's where you see the original, original Skyline tag, the white label. There's actually a first and a second edition of that. But I don't know exactly if it denotes earlier or later, but there's one with like a more detailed skyline and one with a less detailed skyline.
Okay.
Yeah. You'll see one with like it's got like a single orange strip for the skyline, but the other ones will have like multiple layers to it.
And you don't know which one's older?
It's hard to say because like I've heard stories from people who originally bought this stuff, and you'll see what's supposed to be a first edition tag, but the guy says he bought it at a sportswear store in 1979 or something.
Okay. Yeah. So
yeah.
Well, if anybody out there knows which one's older, we want that info. We'll put those two tags on the screens for you guys to like look at. And they just basically like in the vintage world, we call that the white tag, right?
Yeah. White label.
Yeah. White label. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's what I would call it.
Yeah. And obviously that's like the first iteration, the OG 70s. And do you know when that tag got phased out for the black tag?
I would say around 1981, 82, because I was actually looking at the, Great Pacific Ironworks catalog from, 1982. And it actually features products with both the white and the black label. So I think it was like a sort of a gradual transition.
Huh, that's cool.
White label stuff can take you into like the very early 80s.
Okay. Do you have catalogs?
Oh yeah, I have PDF scans of them that you can find online.
Yeah, I've had a couple opportunities to buy them and they all like fell through. I've never been able to get any.
Invested in getting the actual pieces. I'd probably only get catalogs if it was like a big lot of them, because you can suck a lot of money into getting them one by one, because they go for a clip sometimes.
Yeah. Fun side note on the catalog. So there's this guy, the college picker. He was on the podcast like in my first round of like 10 podcasts, maybe like way back years ago. And he had found a lot of these catalogs and he started to put them online like to make this archive of catalogs.
Oh, I think I've like heard of that. Yeah. Yeah.
And Patagonia shut him down, man. They were like, you can't do that. So they sent him a cease and desist, like lawyered up and shut him down. They didn't want all that stuff just like accessible via the internet, which is very interesting because we'll talk more about this like as we get into the more modern history, but it's kind of like, that stuff was produced. It's free. Once you put something out like that, it's like in the public space, right? Like if you put a catalog out there to the world, it's in the public space. So like what difference does it make if it's on the internet or not? You've already put it out to the public. I feel like he could have easily won that if he wanted to fight it, but who wants to fight some stupid thing like that against Patagonia? No, it's not really worth it.
Well, yeah, at this point, the earlier catalogs are basically public domain at this point. You can like find them on the Internet Archive if you really, do an hour or so of searching. But the ones from the 90s are still, you got to get like, you got to know somebody who has one to really, if you want to like look something up. But there's some Instagram accounts that'll post certain pages from them.
All right, everybody, little intermission from the show here. As you know, this is the free 45-minute version of the show. But if you want to get the full 2 hours of this Patagonia episode, what you're going to have to do is go jump on the Patreon. You can find that link down below in the show notes or up in one of the corners here. Click on it, jump on the Patreon. It's $5 a month, hundreds of episodes for you to learn from on there. On the paid portion of this episode, full 2 hours, you're going to learn a lot of values of certain garments. What are the most valuable Patagonia garments? What to look out for when you're shopping for Patagonia? Details that help you date Patagonia. Differences between certain garments that can make it from $150 to $200 garment to $1,000 garment. You're going to learn a lot of stuff on the paid portion. So tap in, and enough of that. We'll get back to the free version. It's funny, too, when you look at histories like this, guaranteed there's more knowledge about the brand's history outside of the brand than like people who work in the brand.
in some cases.
A lot of time, Patagonia is, they do have an archive. They probably have like a couple people that work strictly on their archive.
I know that for a fact.
Yeah. Right. And then they also, but I think like when you look at the history, like they probably only started that archive like 10 years ago or something. It wasn't like they always kept an archive they did maybe 20 years ago, but most companies don't think to start an archive like from the beginning because they don't know they're going to be there 40 years down the line. So then there's left scrambling to figure out their own company history at a point, just like the rest of us trying to put the pieces back together.
Mm-hmm. Because that was the thing about Chouinard as well. He doesn't like waste at all. That dude, he would not want to keep anything for posterity. Anything that they produced, they wanted to sell and get out of there. So anything preserved from them is mostly accidental or, again, in the last 20 years, as they've been doing the archives, they've been asking for donations. So friends and family of the brand will be sending them things. But obviously in the 90s, more recent, they've been saving like, samples, wear tests, that sort of thing. But they actually have a pretty substantial collection at this point, pretty comprehensive. It took some time to catch up. They weren't always archival and thinking about, how the company would look 50 years on when they didn't even know that it would last 50 years.
Yeah, totally. Okay, let's keep moving through the history. So we're at the early tag into like the black tag, but then I guess, you know, most people would know the stand-up short. We'll put that on screen. Mm-hmm. And also, like, their most popular product of all time, as everybody knows, like, they're famous for inventing or creating or making a garment out of the pile, fleece fabric. Yep.
They essentially, yeah, the first to make the pile. Yeah, I think the story goes that Chouinard was again overseas and he found like a bolt of like synthetic pile fabric and he really liked the properties of it and really wanted to make something out of that. So when he came back to Ventura, he sent out his wife to go to like these garment factories and look for something similar. And yeah, the story goes that she found this bolt of fabric that was originally used for toilet seat covers and it was a synthetic fleece material. And so they bought all that and started making jackets out of it. And that was around like, yeah, 76, 77.
Yeah. I love that story. So depending on how old you are, if you went to your grandma's house and she had one of those like fluffy toilet seat covers, that's basically the same material. And I always thought those were nasty. I'm like, this is nasty. Like you got like a freaking fuzzy toilet seat cover.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, this thing must get full of mad germs.
No, but you gotta remember, up until the 70s, people were using like wool sweaters and like trimmings from animals for their insulation. So this synthetic pile was like pretty revolutionary in the fact that it had these like water repellent properties, it's quick drying, it was very durable.
Breathable as well. Yeah. Like you would, you know, like a lot of things weren't breathable. And you're right. When you trace the history of all sports apparel, cottons like weren't even a thing until like late 1800s, like the big, boom in cotton. Basically everything was wool.
Yeah.
Bathing suits were fucking wool. Like how could you wear a bathing suit out of wool? It's got to be the most uncomfortable thing. Like, football jerseys were wool. People would like sweat their ass off all day in these like thick wool garments, right? So
yeah, when you look at those photos, I feel for them. Football players in the 20s, yeah, wild.
And again, like coming back to innovation and functionality, it all comes from sport, right? Like imagine how good it would have been when colleges and everyone else finally started getting cotton and they had sweatshirts and t-shirts and prior to like t-shirts were created as an undergarment. Basically the t-shirt is underwear. It kind of like morphed its way into acceptable everyday fashion like way later, but it was only underwear. Then it became acceptable for like sports or like working out, and then eventually became iconic in fashion. But you know, so yeah, you have like this evolution of fabrics and, it's super interesting that toilet seat covers are a big part of that evolution.
Yes. Yes, indeed. they were the first to do, as they call it now, retro pile, their deep pile. And those jackets, went through into the 80s and, their next big innovation would be their snap tee. And that was actually a collaboration between Patagonia and Malden Mills, who we now know as Polar Tech. And they actually co-developed what we know now as their Polar Tech fabric, or as Patagonia called it then, Cinchilla. And that was sort of them trying to solve a problem where they had low pile fleece before that, but it would pill very easily. Mat out, and it was just too heavy. So them and Malden Mills got together and developed this like very lightweight, but still, you know, sturdy, low pile fleece, which they then made into the snap tee in around like 1985, I think. Yeah.
Nice. I didn't know that. So
yeah, people don't know that Polar Tech was you have Patagonia to thank for it.
Yeah, that's crazy. So when, you know, obviously Polar Tech would have been like a fabric factory technology innovator at that time. And I guess they like came together and they worked on a project, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Was there like legal battles at any point of like who gets rights to this stuff, or like did anything weird go down?
Well, I think I think Patagonia actually had like a 2-year exclusivity deal with Malden Mills, where they were the only people to use the fabric. But then after that, that's why like later in the '80s, you got this like explosion of like people using Polar Tech, North Face, Eddie Bauer, LL Bean, that sort of thing.
Ah, makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Crazy. So I have this like sample of, the one I have is probably from like the early 90s, I guess, but it's like a sample of the Snap Tee, and it has all the different, I'll put a picture on here, guys, or maybe a little quick clip of it. And it talks about like, it's the most copied fleece of all time. And you guys will even know that now, because there's been like recent lawsuits within the last couple of years of big, huge, because it fucking had a massive boom in the last like 5 years. Like it came back into like fashion and streetwear big, right? Because there was a time when like fleece never went anywhere really for like function, but like it, everything comes and goes out of like the limelight trend cycle for fashion.
Yeah. Yeah.
And fleece came back in hard recently. There was a few lawsuits by Patagonia against people for literally copying the Snap Tee. I think one was fucking Gap.
Yeah. 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 It was Gap.
And I think like, yeah, it was Gap. So they sued Gap for copying this design, because everyone wants to make that fleece that just has that look. The Snap Tee has a certain look. It's like the most iconic garment of fleece out there. And you can copyright like a design that's specific. Mm-hmm. There's certain things you can copyright, certain things you can't copyright, but you can copyright that. So
yeah, very and over the years, people have made Snap Tee like garments, but they've, tweaked it a little so that it's not too egregious. But that's actually what led to Patagonia falling out with LL Bean was, so LL Bean is actually one of the first retailers to stock Patagonia through their mail order catalog. Like you can go way back in the '70s and you'll see it being listed like, along with like Eddie Bauer and other brands like that. And there are actually some old pile of fleeces from the '70s that'll have an LL Bean tag in it. Those are really cool.
Yeah, I have one. Reverse deep pile vest. And if I'm not mistaken, I think I might have a stand up short that has it too.
Mm. Yep. Yep. Very rare. They also did REI co-branding. But once the Snap Tee came along and LL Bean wanted to start making their own stuff and gradually phase out like these third party brands, they started copying Patagonia's design, and that sort of led to falling out in like the later 80s, I believe.
Yeah, that's a cool piece of the history there, because I think originally LL Bean would have been like a outfitter, right?
Yeah.
Versus like a manufacturer. A lot of these companies started as outfitters, where they're like they're stocking other like primarily other people's brands. I think even when you go back to the history of Levi's, like Levi's started as a dry goods provider for miners.
And it was Levi Strauss and Company. It wasn't just Levi's.
Yeah. And then eventually they hit on a product. They're like, wow, we're just going all in on this product and we're beginning to be manufacturing now. But so yeah, similar to LL Bean, they were just stocking people's stuff, co-branding with Patagonia. And then nowadays, like it's just strictly a manufacturer.
Almost exclusively all their own private label stuff.
Yeah.
Under the LLB name.
So this Snap Tee is relatively unchanged. I mean, you could probably talk about some detail changes, but relatively unchanged from the first fucking iteration, 1985 till today. They've probably never stopped making it. I would guarantee if you looked at their books, it's like a number one seller, number one moneymaker. Driver of the company. They put out like 10 colors a year, which partly like becomes when we talk about collecting, it's like, gotta catch them all. Pokemon, you gotta get all colors. Yeah. You gotta get all the prints. You gotta get all the fucking different years. And you can look at the colors over the time span, and you're like, wow, in the late 80s, they were going like major day glow colors. There's like some crazy bright ones. And then certain years they muted the color tone back, and certain years they're putting out really interesting prints. And it really lends itself to collectability.
It's definitely, it's one of the rabbit holes that you can get into when you're first getting into Patagonia, where there are some people I know who just collect the snap tees. They just want every, or they want like certain prints, every color from like a certain era. Yeah.
Yeah, that's super cool. So let's talk then. Let's talk while we're on snap tee. Actually, I kind of want to rewind a bit. I want to go back to this. Yeah. I want to go back to the deep pile fleece talk for a sec. So we told the history of it, but let's talk about the actual details of it. You know, from mm-hmm. my knowledge, there's a pullover that's got a yeah. quarter zip that has like mm-hmm. kind of a thick a heavy collar.
Yeah.
There's the full zip with the ribbing that's kind of like a jacket. They probably called it a jacket at that time, right?
Yeah, yeah.
They made a vest for mm-hmm. sure, because I have that.
They also made a hoodie.
Yeah, fuck. I need the hoodie so bad.
Those are insanely rare. Yeah.
You don't have one?
No. The earliest piece I have is from like the late 80s, unfortunately.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, the hoodie is so epic. I've seen them come and go. I've never been able to get my hands on one. I don't even know if I've seen one in person, like at an event.
Mm.
Which says a lot, because I've been to like all these crazy true vintage events.
Oh, yeah.
And seen so much stuff, you know. I think I've literally seen like some ended eBay auctions for them. So the hoodie is like the grail. My grail, I've talked about many, many times, is the burnt orange color, which I have a couple of now, but I'm still mm-hmm. missing the proper white tag.
Yeah, they, especially in the early days, they would really mix and match. Like you'll see, jackets that are typically don't have ribbing, sometimes you'll find some with it, just on like the waist even, or they switched out the pocket design sometimes. Later in the 70s, they also did like a bomber jacket style, which they brought into like the late 80s. But yeah, they did a lot with retro pile back then. But those are the big ones.
Yeah, and then so like, for color palettes, you have the oatmeal, which is kind of mm-hmm. like most common. You have a blue color. Then there's the burnt orange, which I just said is my kind of favorite colorway. Is there more colors in it?
There's like a heather gray, and there's like a bluish gray as well. There's actually a great photo of the one that Yvonne wore back in the day was like a bluish gray, and they actually have it on display at the headquarters now.
Yeah, I don't think I have the bluish gray. And then mm-hmm. like these pile fleeces kind of had a timeline too, because we're saying this it started in like the late 70s. The snap tee didn't come out till mid 80s. So there's like a 6-year period or 7-year period of these deep piles going through a different timeline. And like for people who've never seen them, obviously there'll be pictures on screen, but like it's reversed, right? So like the fleece on these is on the fuzzy part is on the inside, and the outside is like the backing of the fabric. So like to the untrained person, or not untrained, but someone who's never seen one, you kind of look at it and you go like, this is weird,
mm-hmm.
right? Because it's
which is funny, because their like initial thinking is what like anybody would think. Oh, you want the insulation facing inwards. Like that'll keep you warm. That'll be the way to go. And that's how they kept it through the late 80s until what is now known as the retro pile cardigan was created in 1988, which is they reversed it. They put the fleece on the outside.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And then we see that, you know, that's still something that's in fashion, and we're like, that's the way it should be. Yeah. That's why like these old ones look weird to us.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's cool. Okay, let's jump into back to snap tee talk here. So you and like we talked about, everyone collects these things. There's so many colors. Like what are some of the most sought after currently?
So there's like a golden era when it comes to snap tees, and that's from like the early 90s. It's when they started it around 92 is when they did the first printed pattern snap tees, and that ran all the way through like 1999. And they didn't start making them again until like the mid 2010s, I believe. But there are a few patterns.
So they had a full gap of no printed fleece?
Yeah, people don't realize that. From 99 through, I want to say like 2013, 2014, they didn't make printed snap tees.
Wow.
There's like a couple exceptions where it's called a snap marsupial, but it isn't exactly a snap tee that has like a tropical pattern. But yeah, for the most part, they just ended it in 99. Spring 99 was like the last time they did it.
So wow, that's I had no idea about that. I thought they just kind of put out different patterns. So there you go.
No.
So I know that like the pattern you're wearing, talk about the pattern you're wearing.
Yeah, so this is a switchback from fall 98, made famous by Tom Hanks in Castaway. This is probably my favorite pattern of all time, I would say. Definitely like a top 10, maybe even top 5 in terms of desirability. But then you also have the Mini Haha, which is another wild pattern. There's a specific colorway called Flame, and that regularly is one of the most like expensive ones to go. But I'd say like the top one is easily Zen Turtles. That's from I think 97, I believe.
Yeah, Zen Turtles.
Yeah, it's Zen like Turtles. Mini Haha.
Turtle pattern. We'll put these all on the screen. I don't even know like the names of them all. So the ones you just
mentioned. Yeah, we'll have to think of rounding off the names. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I have a little stash of ones I found over the years. A few years ago, I sold off quite a few.
Yeah.
And certain ones I seem to only find in like weird sizes, like kid sizes. Mm. There's like these like geometric ones that I always find in kid sizes or.
Yeah, they would do so the way they would do it is they'd have patterns for snap peas for a season. And then, for kids fleeces, they would actually do specific colorways of those that are only for kids fleeces.
Yeah. And some of the kids ones were sick because, you know, they get a little more kind of.
Oh yeah. The colors are wild.
Colors are wild.
Mm-hmm. And that's like the big draw with the 90s stuff. The color blocking was just like really on point. The refinement and just the style was really cool. That and these printed snap tees from the 90s, they don't have a chest pocket. So that's how they differentiate a solid from a printed.
So yours right now has no flap pocket.
Yeah, there's no chest pocket. You have hand warmer pockets on the sides. So that's how they did printed snap tees in the 90s. The solid colors would be with the nylon chest pocket.
Crazy. I guess I never really thought about that either.
And I think it lets the print sort of speak for itself a little bit more because you don't it's not broken up by the pocket.
Yeah. So obviously, like that is one of the telltale details of a snap tee. It's like the cut of it, but that little flat pocket with the snap. It's got the snaps on the neck. There's like these details. So it's interesting. How many like other than these two different cut versions, is there any other like variants of snap tees?
Well, like the earliest ones, they added the chest pocket, I think in like the late 80s, early 90s. That was like a thing where people in the field wanted a pocket to like put stuff in. I think it was specifically somebody who wanted a place for their sunglasses, I believe. That's how they added the chest pocket. But the earliest ones, they just have the snap neck.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, and there's a lot of questions out there about how you date Patagonia. You know, we're kind of talking like obviously like as we go through this timeline, you're going to see the differences in the dates. So like certain things are very obvious. Like if you see the white label, you know it's like it's old. But they also did they made like retro white label pieces too, just as like throwback. So there's that shit out there too. But that's pretty obvious.
Mm-hmm.
To anybody who knows vintage. But the real telltale, I think once you get into like the mid to late 80s, they have the inside tag for sure on the snap tees, right? You can pick out the date on.
Yeah. It'll be a printed paper label. That'll be on like the interior of typically on like the side seam.
Does yours have it?
The one I'm wearing. Yeah.
Can you show it?
Yeah, sure.
So this little paper tag, like most companies, has the season and the year. It's kind of done more for internal purposes, so they can.
It's gonna be mad faded. It's probably mad faded, but
yeah. Okay, can't even see because of the light.
Yeah. But it's there.
It's there. So it's always on the side seam. This little tag, and we'll put a few examples on the screen of pictures. But it would be like FA for fall, SS for spring summer, and it'll have a date. But the problem is with these dates, they only use the last two digits of the year. So yours says what? Yours says like...
It'll be FA98.
Yeah, so his says FA98, which is obviously, you know, it's 98, but there's some that just say FA8, right? Which mm-hmm. could be 88. It's probably 88, but then people always ask me, is that 88 or is that 2008? And some, there's like a little bit of confusion on some of the years. You kind of have to do your best guessing beyond that.
Well, I'll say that when they first did the these paper tags, the way they did dating was it would be a single letter and a single number. So like I have a fall 1988 retro cardigan that just says F8.
Yeah. And then when they got to 08, was it F08 or FA08?
Well, when they got into the 90s, they would do like the last two digits of the year. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah. There you go. That's how you date it. It's mm-hmm. super handy. It's super handy that they have that. I didn't even know that for like a lot of years when I was collecting older stuff. It obviously none of those tags are on the deep piles. It wasn't until like the later 80s that they started using those tags, but that's how you can kind of check it out.
And then if you want to get really nerdy, they also have a style number above that, which if you got like if you can cross-reference catalogs, that'll that can tell you a lot as well.
Well, there you have it, guys. The end of the free 45 minutes has come. Now what you're going to want to do is you're going to want to go jump on the Patreon, which is down in the show notes. Or what you can do is join here right on YouTube and get the full 2 hours. Patreon's just $5 a month. You get a 1 week free trial, so you can go listen to this episode right now for free. You're going to learn a lot in the rest of the talk I have with Nick. And or join right here again, right here on YouTube, or free 1 week trial and then $5 on the Patreon. Thank you guys all for tuning in. I appreciate you so much. Make sure you sub to this channel because lots more podcasts coming your way. And there's over 100 episodes to go back and rewatch. There you go. See you on the next show.